Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you today with a show I think is of great importance to everyone living in the United States, if not the world. Our guest is Anthony Arnov, the author of a brand new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, a book that I think has received acclaim already as the definitive statement on for why the United States should remove its troops immediately from Iraq. He will be our guest today on Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
All that stands between the Internet's transformation from an open forum to a paid speech zone overseen by phone and cable companies is the floor of the U.S. Senate. At a June 28th Senate Commerce Committee hearing on an omnibus telecommunications bill covering everything from wireless phone regulation to video franchising, an amendment to protect the principle of network neutrality called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act failed in a tie vote. Illinois Democrat Senator Barack Obama is a co-sponsor of the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, and he also regularly produces short podcasts on a variety of issues of concern to him.
And it's because the Internet's a neutral platform that I can put on this podcast and transmit it over the Internet without having to go through some corporate media middleman. I can say what I want without censorship. I don't have to pay a special charge.
Senator Obama believes overhauling telecommunications law without preserving the principle of network neutrality is dangerously irresponsible.
Allowing the bells and cable companies to act as gatekeepers with control over Internet access would make the Internet like cable, a producer-driven market with barriers to entry for website creators and preferential treatment for specific sites based not on merit, the number of hits, but on relationships with the corporate gatekeeper.
11 senators have already declared their support for the Internet Freedom Preservation Act. Meanwhile, the omnibus telecom bill at the center of the debate is being loaded down with all kinds of special interest provisions. On the good side are amendments which would expand opportunities for low-power FM community radio stations and would abolish state laws prohibiting public investment in broadband data networks. On the bad side are provisions which would allow phone and cable companies to cherry-pick the areas of communities in which they would first build out advanced communication services and void state consumer protection rules regarding wireless phone service. At least one senator has vowed to block this debate from going forward unless meaningful protection for network neutrality is preserved. Visit SaveTheInternet.com for the latest updates.
Without fanfare, America Online has launched its new paid email scheme it calls Certified Mail. The program allows anyone to pay AOL to bypass its spam filters, guaranteeing delivery to AOL's millions of subscribers. The company claims it's designed to crack down on spam and to help not-for-profit charities targeted by scammers. But the first message sent through AOL's paymail system promoted a sale at online merchant Overstock.com.
More than 400 concerned citizens packed an auditorium in Asheville, North Carolina on June 28th to talk media ownership with the two Democrats on the Federal Communications Commission. Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein heard more than 5 hours of testimony, the overwhelming majority of which opposed FCC moves to allow further media concentration. This is but the first in a series of town meetings on the future of media planned over the next few months.
The smallest of the big four music conglomerates has reached a settlement in the state of New York's ongoing payola investigation. EMI does not admit to any wrongdoing, although documents from the New York's attorney general detail how executives at EMI's various record labels, including Capitol Records, gave away cash, trips, and other merchandise to radio stations in order to play its artists. Stations could receive up to $1,000 per EMI-related song they added to their playlists. EMI's agreed to pay nearly $4 million to settle the Paola dispute and may still offer trips, meals, and entertainment to radio stations under the deal, though none may be given out in direct exchange for airplay. The state of New York's collected more than $30 million in fines from the four largest music conglomerates, Sony, BMG, Universal, Warner, and EMI, though it has not yet settled with any radio broadcast companies, which are also under investigation.
And now an update to a story we first brought you in April, a major investigative report that conclusively documented the widespread use of fake news on local TV newscasts has finally caught the attention of FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. The agency's enforcement bureau has reportedly been tasked to open up an official investigation into the 77 television stations caught passing off corporate or government-sponsored video news releases as actual journalism. Fines for such deception typically cost a station around $32,000, though the penalty can be multiplied tenfold if multiple violations occur. And 14 of the 77 stations outed for airing fake news did it more than once. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you on this lovely summer day. Today we've got a terrific show, one I've been wanting to do for a very long time. Our guest is Anthony Arnove, editor and author who's worked closely with people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. He was the editor with Howard Zinn of Voices of a People's History of the United States. He has also written for publications like the Financial Times, The Nation, In These Times, Monthly Review, and Z. And he has a brand new book out, courtesy of the New Press, that has just been published, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. The book features a foreword and afterword by Howard Zinn. It has received praise unlike very few books of our times. It is a book all about what's going on in Iraq today and the U.S. role there. It is a definitive and presentable and short statement, I might say, for those of you who fear a book like this might run into the hundreds and hundreds of pages. It's really an extended, cogent pamphlet. It's my pleasure to welcome Anthony Arnove to Media Matters. Anthony?
Thanks for having me on the show, Bob.
Yeah, well, let's just talk about the book. I mean, it just has come out. Why did you decide to write it? What drove you to want to write Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal?
Well, I would have rather not written it, to be honest, but I felt compelled by the crimes that were being committed in the name of liberating the Iraqi people to speak out. And I was also struck by a phenomenon, which was that so many people I knew who had opposed the initial invasion of Iraq, who had in many cases marched in demonstrations or organized before the war began, had come to feel to one degree or another that now that the United States had invaded Iraq, it couldn't just leave, that somehow an occupation of the country could bring about democracy or rebuild that country or prevent civil war from breaking out, and they were in a position of reluctantly supporting an occupation that flowed directly from an invasion they opposed. And as I encountered those arguments, I was struck by some historical parallels to a book that Howard Zinn had written in 1967 called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And I went back and reread that book and was just really surprised at how many of the arguments Howard was making at that time were relevant to the situation we were dealing with in Iraq today. And I thought that really there was a need in the anti-war movement and the broader political discourse to have a discussion of the arguments why the occupation of Iraq would only lead to more suffering and harm and make the world a more dangerous, not a safer place.
Yeah, before we go through the book and the argument in detail, Anthony Arnove, perhaps you could just address that issue a little more. What are the similarities between the U.S. War in Iraq and the war in Vietnam? And maybe what are a couple of the dissimilarities?
Oh, absolutely. There are dissimilarities and similarities, so I think it's important to look at both. In terms of the similarities, the most notable similarity, I think, is that the U.S. intervened in Vietnam and in Iraq with noble claims about its goals, but in reality with far baser motives. In the case of Iraq, we heard a lot of rhetoric about democracy and human rights and weapons of mass destruction, but really the intervention in Iraq was motivated by geopolitical strategy of the United States in the wake of 9/11 and the fact that Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves and sits in a region with two-thirds of world oil reserves. And so it was a very strategic, calculated intervention having nothing to do with the stated aims. In the case of Vietnam, we were bringing democracy and freedom to Asia, fighting communism, and so on. But the reality is, again, the intervention in Vietnam was meant to establish U.S. power and hegemony in a part of the world that was economically and politically valuable to the United States. And in both cases, the people rejected the intervention. The Vietnamese people rose up and spent years, and many, many people lost their lives fighting that invasion and occupation. And today we see the Iraqis in a similar situation, opposing this alleged liberation, rising up against it, and it's creating tremendous violence in Iraq as it did in Vietnam. The difference, the most important difference, I think, is that today Iraq is far more important to U.S. strategy, global strategy, than Vietnam was in 1967, and that's unfortunately a very sobering thought, because you look at how long the United States prolonged the horror in Vietnam, and to this day, people in Vietnam are suffering the consequences of Agent Orange and the toxic legacy of that brutal war. And in reality, Iraq is far more valuable as in terms of the resources it possesses and where it fits into the world economy, where it is geographically in terms of trade routes and the energy resources of the region it's in. So I think a lot more is at stake for the United States in at least creating the appearance of victory in Iraq. And so that means we have to take very seriously the degree to which we're going to have to organize and mobilize to compel the United States to withdraw troops.
Anthony Arnov, Noam Chomsky, of course, written a lot about the Vietnam War and the Iraq War. And he likes to note that although Vietnam, in one sense, is considered a massive defeat for the United States, because obviously the United States was driven from the country and was unable to have a friendly U.S. government put in place in South Vietnam or North Vietnam, for that matter. In his view, you could also regard the record, though, as one ultimately a victory, because the United States so devastated Vietnam and made it almost unlivable, so destroyed it, that it sent a message, really, to all other countries in the region, if not the world, you know, we can make your life a living hell if you piss us off.
Yeah, both things, I think, are true. But it's important, I think, to understand the extent to which the U.S. did not achieve its maximal objectives in Vietnam. The fact that the world overwhelmingly perceived the victory of the Vietnamese against the United States as a major defeat to the United States, and the extent to which that then impaired the ability of the United States to project power around the world. The Vietnam syndrome was a very real phenomenon that led to a skepticism among a large layer of the U.S. public about foreign intervention. It forced the United States to engage in more covert operations and, as a result, probably saved a number of countries from far more devastating interventions in the period after the Vietnam War. And it was in part to dispel the Vietnam syndrome that the United States invaded Iraq in 1991 and again invaded Iraq in 2003. You can go to a number of statements from Bush 1 and Bush 2 administration officials in which they said this is going to dispel once and forever the Vietnam syndrome. And the reality is it's come back to bite them very badly. And if they're defeated in Iraq, it would be a more significant reversal than they encountered in Vietnam.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Anthony Arnov, the author of the brand new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, just published by New Press, a book that has come out with extraordinary acclaim. It has a foreword and an afterword by Howard Zinn, a frequent guest here on Media Matters, endorsements from just an extraordinary range of global intellectuals, political activists, and figures, including on the cover Arundhati Roy. The book is short and sweet. It is, the exact figure, 140 pages approximately of text, including appendices, 120 or so for the book. And it is a cogent argument for the case for immediate withdrawal of American troops. And let's, before we go any further, I want to alert our listeners that I pre-recorded this program with Anthony Arnov a couple of weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, let Anthony Arnov and me do the yakking today. Anthony, the first chapter is called A War of Choice, and your first sentence, I think, is shows how you don't waste any time in this book getting to the point. Every single argument the Bush administration made to justify the invasion of Iraq has turned out to be false. That sort of lays it right out there. And you call this a war of choice. Aren't all wars wars of choices?
Well, in many respects, yes. But it's important to remember that this war was sold on a very different premise. The Bush administration claimed that in invading Iraq, it was responding defensively. It was preempting an attack, an imminent threat to U.S. interests, that Saddam Hussein possessed terrible weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, nuclear weapons, that there was an iron-clad, bulletproof case that these weapons existed and were a gathering threat as the government of Iraq was making alliances with terrorist organizations, including, it was repeatedly implied, Al-Qaeda, and the government, of course, repeatedly tried to make a connection between Iraq and the attacks of September 11th in the minds of the public. And so it wasn't sold as a war of choice. It was sold as a defensive war, as something that the U.S. was compelled to do, having exhausted all other options, all diplomatic options, and so forth. And so that's an important point to bring up. The other thing is that, and this has received almost no notice in the media, but the United States' case for war was taken apart piece by piece by the anti-war movement and by independent media in this country before the invasion. There's not a single thing that we now know that wasn't predicted by the anti-war movement and by independent voices observing the buildup to war in Iraq. We cast doubt on all the claims about weapons of mass destruction. We cast doubt on the claims about the connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda and the attacks of September 11th. And we certainly called into question the idea that the Iraqi people would greet U.S. troops as liberators and would quietly stand by and allow their country to be occupied. And it's quite significant because today, as each one of these claims of the Bush administration has been exposed as specious, the media looks around a bit bewildered as if who could have possibly predicted this. And that's based on the fact that they systematically excluded those skeptical voices, those critical voices in the buildup to the war.
Well, you would wonder if the news media, after realizing all the stated reasons that were in the media, the mainstream media in 2003, 2004, for justifying the invasion, if those reasons have been proven wrong, I would assume journalists are hard at work now trying to track down the real reasons. What do you think the reasons are? Why did the United States invade and occupy Iraq?
Well, I wish the media were asking that question. But I think the reasons have to do with one topic we discussed earlier, oil. Iraq sits in a region with two-thirds of global oil reserves, and we're in a situation today where each barrel of oil that's extracted from the earth is more expensive than the barrel extracted before it. The U.S. is having to diversify its sources of oil around the world. It's finding it's having to go to more politically unstable terrains, more environmentally unstable terrains to extract oil. And oil, of course, is a vital component of the U.S. capitalist system and also to the U.S. military apparatus, which relies on oil for transport, planes, boats, ships, tanks. The entire military apparatus heavily depends on hydrocarbons. And in addition, the Middle East is sitting on the largest reserves of natural gas. And as short-sighted and as oil-dependent as our economy is, the oil companies and military and strategic planners are realizing they're also going to have to increasingly dominate natural gas reserves as those resources become more important to the world economy.
Yeah,
and in doing, you know, in achieving so-called regime change in Iraq, there was the hope not only could you gain greater hegemony over those resources, but you could also establish a military base in Iraq and use Iraq as a staging ground for the projection of power in the region, including the pursuit of regime change in other countries. And remember that at the time of the invasion, there was very aggressive talk about regime change in Syria and in Iran.
Anthony Ardov, on those two points, and I think these are the explanations that most analysts return to, whatever their political views, serious analysts, that it's about oil and it's about geopolitical power, military power in the region. Do you think looking at Iraq now, and we're going to go into more detail on the reality of the occupation and what's actually taking place and the resistance there, but do you think there's much of a chance that when the dust finally clears on this occupation, that the United States will be able to control the oil and maintain a huge military apparatus within the borders of Iraq?
I think it's very unlikely. The reality is that the Iraqi people strongly oppose the idea of military bases in their country. They've grown each day more resentful of the U.S. occupation and have come to feel that the government that is now in place is a government that largely reflects the interests of the occupying powers, not the interests of the Iraqi people. And I think that's a very volatile situation, and it will be very difficult for the United States to achieve its initial aims. I mean, the idea of being able to create a stable client state in Iraq with military bases, with a friendly relationship to the United States that largely agrees to the economic and military desires of the United States in Iraq and the Middle East, I think, would be to pull a serious rabbit out of this hat, and I don't see how that scenario is likely to emerge. The problem, of course, is that for that not to emerge would be a serious reversal of U.S. interests in the region. So I fear a very prolonged and bloody conflict as the U.S. tries to continue its Sisyphean task of achieving that.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Anthony Ardov, author of the new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. You talk about the reality of occupation, and I think that there's certainly been a great deal of coverage in the news media in the United States of bombings, of deaths. So there seems to be coverage in the news media in the United States of the occupation that did not make it look exactly like a day at the beach. But do you think that coverage is missing something? I mean, is there more to the story than most Americans are getting?
I think there's much more to the story. First of all, I feel that we're seeing far fewer images of the consequences of this occupation than during the Vietnam War, for example, the public saw in terms of daily the number of photographs or clips on television that give a picture of the human cost of war, not just the dead bodies, but the injured, the maimed. We also, I don't think, are hearing in the news media often enough the voice of Iraqis themselves. Around the revelations that have come out in the past few weeks and since March of this year about the massacre in Haditha, we've heard a few Iraqis who have commented on that massacre, which took place in November of last year, in which 24 Iraqis were wantonly slaughtered, execution style. But what's interesting is that Iraqis have been talking about that massacre since last November, DOE in this country since March, beginning in a slow trickle to get information about what's unfolded there. We're also, I think, getting an image that the violence in Iraq is overwhelmingly caused by Iraqi insurgents, by people who are alleged to have connections to al-Zarqawi or to al-Qaeda or to be foreign fighters who have come into Iraq because they oppose the United States, because they want to establish an Islamic regime there. But the reality is that the opposition in Iraq is far more widespread and is far more popular than the media would suggest. And also, of course, that frame ignores the extent to which the United States is perpetrating violence in Iraq and is creating the conditions in which so much violence is breaking out.
Clearly, you're not getting a lot of your information on what's going on the ground in Iraq outside of the green zone where the journalists are cordoned off in Baghdad from the U.S. news media. How do you, you know, develop your understanding of what the reality of occupation is there, if not through the New York Times or CBS News?
Sure. Well, that's an important question. First of all, there are a few very courageous reporters who have gone into Iraq unembedded. From the United States, we had Dar Jamal, who spent a significant period of time in Iraq right after the invasion, and his dispatches have been invaluable, and he continues to write very perceptively.
Who does he write for?
And knowledgeably about Iraq. Well, he has his own website, but you can also read his reports regularly on Common Dreams and on Truth Out and a number of other websites, and IPS. Mm-hmm. Sometimes syndicates his reports. Then there have been reporters such as Patrick Coburn and Robert Fisk, who reports for The Independent in England, who have gone into Iraq and have strayed from their minders and strayed from the green zone to give a picture of what's happening on the ground in Iraq. In Italy, we had Giuliana Segrena, the reporter from Il Manifesto. And we also have Iraqis who have been increasingly trying to get out the story of what's happening in Iraq. I was recently on the Laura Flanders show on Air America with an Iraqi journalist who has been filing reports from northern Iraq, trying to get out a picture of what's happening on the ground there, much different than the picture that we're getting in the media here in the United States. But at the same time, it's not as if reading the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times, you can't also find useful information. It's just a question of how that information is framed and where it appears in the story. Is it in the headline? Is it on the front page? Or is it in paragraph 33? On page 824 or 825. And so I think it's important not to ignore the mainstream media. It's important to understand how they're framing the story, but often also to find those little nuggets of information that are buried in the stories that are being filed by the establishment press.
Anthony Arnov, in the occupation of Iraq, I mean, there's been some discussion, but probably not a great deal in the U.S. news media, about the corruption of the occupying forces, all the money being spent, how it's gone into, been largely unaccountable, huge sums that have gone into various private hands, U.S. firms primarily, but also others. I mean, how significant is the sort of the cronyism of a sort of corporate interest? The Halliburton is the name that always comes to mind, in playing a role in what's happening in the occupation of Iraq today.
Well, I think it's quite significant that the United States went into Iraq claiming that they were going to rebuild the country, that they would be spending billions of dollars on humanitarian assistance, that they'd be building roads and schools and so on. And they made those promises not only to the U.S. public but to the Iraqi people. But the reality has turned out quite different. Today in Iraq, the power supply, the supply of electricity, is lower than before the invasion. That's a time when the United States, through the United Nations, had imposed comprehensive sanctions on the country that had badly devastated its infrastructure. So it's even worse today than before the invasion under sanctions, under dictatorship. The access to safe drinking water of most Iraqis is at a lower level than before the invasion. Security is at a lower level. People are unemployed at a far greater rate. They're afraid to leave their homes, afraid to send their children to school. And they look around and they see that what little contract work is being done by foreign workers, because companies like Kellogg Brown and Root, the Halliburton subsidiary, don't trust the Iraqi people. They're fearful of the Iraqi people. So they're bringing in workers from Vietnam, from Pakistan, from Turkey, and other countries to work at wages far higher than ordinary Iraqis are making. And that's fueling anger, that's fueling resentment. It's fueling a sentiment among a wide layer of people that things were better even under the dictatorship than they are under occupation. And it's leading people to feel like they have no future in the country. And then there's another contradiction. Even though Iraq has, as we discussed, the second largest oil reserves in the world, Iraqis are having to stand in line 2-3 days, in some cases, to buy oil, to buy gas, to buy heating and cooking oil. And they're paying wildly inflated prices from what they historically have paid, in part because oil is now being brought into the country, imported into Iraq through contracts that mark up the price of oil so that Kellogg Brown Root, Halliburton, can make money skimming profits off the top of oil imports into Iraq. And that, again, is creating tremendous alienation and frustration among the Iraqi people. The money isn't going to build schools, to build roads, to supply infrastructure. It's going to line the pockets of a handful of cronies of the Bush administration, who in many cases have received their contracts without any competitive bid process, and even when their corruption has been exposed, have had their contracts renewed.
What is it? I mean, there's a lot of sympathy, I think, for the plight of U.S. troops in Iraq, the 130,000-plus soldiers there who are occupying the country, the difficulty that they face. What's your take on that situation?
Well, it's the simple fact is none of those soldiers should be in Iraq. They were sent needlessly in harm's way. They were told that they would be greeted as liberators rather than occupiers. Of course, they quickly found out differently. More than 2,400 of them are now dead, probably 10 times that injured. It's hard to get accurate counts. The conservative estimate is 18,000 injured, but the experience generally is that for every soldier killed, 10 are wounded, and in many cases, terribly wounded and maimed. Last year was the highest rate of suicide for Iraq war veterans, for veterans generally, but you know, mostly we're talking about veterans from the Iraq war, of any year in the United States since 1993, right after the last Iraq invasion. And the toll for soldiers has been enormous. And what is encouraging to me is that many of them are beginning to speak out. Many of them are beginning to question the war. 72% of active duty troops in Iraq, on the ground in Iraq, in a recent Zogby poll, said that they would want to come home within a year. 29% of them said they wanted to leave immediately. Now, that's in a context where soldiers are told they're not allowed to think for themselves. They're just supposed to follow orders. We also have some very courageous, conscientious objectors, people like Camila Mejia, Pablo Paredes, and groups like Iraq Veterans Against War. And that's a very important element. If you go back to the Vietnam War, there's a very crucial but hidden episode of the resistance to that war, which was a rebellion of U.S. soldiers. There's a film that's just come out that your listeners should try to see if they possibly can, called Sir, No Sir, which documents that rebellion. There's also a terrific book by David Courtwright called Soldiers in Revolt, which Howard Zinn contributed, and Howard and David updated recently in a new edition that also tells that story of GIs organizing against the war. And I think we have to do all that we can to support those GIs who are declaring conscientious objection, who are speaking out also those people who are engaged in counter-recruiting efforts, which have already begun to have a serious impact. The U.S. military fell far short of its recruitment goal last year. They haven't fallen as short since right after the Vietnam War. And that's important because when soldiers start speaking out, start organizing, when people stop enlisting, it affects the ability of the military to prosecute an unjust war.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Anthony Arnov, author of the brand new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, which we've been talking about on this program of Media Matters. The book is just published by New Press. It has a foreword and afterword by Howard Zinn. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Please don't call in today. We pre-recorded this show shortly before going on air, so just sit back, relax, and enjoy the program. The book, Anthony Arnov, in addition to having a critique of what's going on there now and a strong argument for withdrawal, has a couple of historical chapters in the middle. One is called The New White Man's Burden, and the second is A History of Occupation. Can you talk a little bit about each of those chapters and why you put them in the book and what the point of those chapters is?
Sure. Well, the reason I included the chapter about the British occupation of Iraq and the modern history of the country is that I think those of us who had studied that history to some degree or another before the invasion thought that based on the history of occupation of Iraq in the 20th century by the British, which was done in the name of liberating the Iraqi people but had a far different consequence, that there would be a skepticism among the Iraqi people at U.S. claims to be liberating them, that there would be a nationalist sentiment that would want to assert the right of self-determination of the Iraqis, the right of Iraqis to control their own resources, to control their own government, and that that nationalist current would express itself in opposition to occupation. And it's important also because, you know, we live in a time when historical amnesia is systematically encouraged in our schools, in our textbooks, but also in the establishment media, which doesn't want to look at the contradictions of our history, the difficult episodes in our history. And so I thought that was important to give a sense of that history and also to give readers a sense of who the Iraqi people are, because part of what's gone on with the invasion of Iraq is a kind of dehumanization of the Iraqi people and an effort to deny them agency, to just treat them as victims, not as people who have acted, who have organized, who have fought for their liberation and who fought for their sovereignty, which the Iraqis had to do to kick out the British and the monarchy that the British installed. And of course, there's a number of interesting parallels, not just the claims that the British were liberating the Iraqi people when they came in to Baghdad and took over the country, but then the attempt to create what was called an Arab facade by the British Colonial Office to give the appearance of Iraqi leadership and control when in reality Britain was calling the shots. Britain was making the major decisions, and Britain was ensuring that the resources of the country were used to its own advantage, not to the advantage of the Iraqi people. And we see a very similar thing happening today. And then in terms of the chapter that I call The New White Man's Burden.
Like, you know, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the old white man's burden, maybe explain what that is.
Well, what I was noting is that in some of the language that was used to describe why the United States had to invade Iraq, had to bring about a regime change there, there was an echo with a very old argument, which was called The White Man's Burden, based on a poem that Rudyard Kipling had written at the time of the U.S. invasion and occupation of the Philippines. And it's important to recall that in 2003, George W. Bush cited the U.S. occupation of the Philippines as a model, as a positive model, I should say, for the occupation of Iraq. cast it as a liberation of the Philippines, as allowing the country to achieve its independence and achieve democracy. But the reality is that the occupation of the Philippines, like the occupation of Iraq today, was a bloody and violent one. It involved widespread massacres of Filipino people and set up a dictatorship that for decades ruled over that country and was backed by the United States and didn't bring about independence in any meaningful sense for decades after the occupation. And so Kipling was talking about the need of the civilized countries, by which he meant Britain and the United States, to take up this obligation of protecting the backward peoples, the dark peoples, the uncivilized peoples of the world. And it's a language that today can seem more obviously racist in its assumptions, but there's a very similar language that we hear justifying the occupation of Iraq today, a revival of these ideas that the United States alone can bring democracy to failed states, that the United States alone can bring values of freedom and can bring peace to these countries that are unable to rule themselves, unable to govern themselves. And there's ultimately, I think, a very similar racist set of assumptions behind this new articulation of the white man's burden, which has been done, we should acknowledge, has been articulated most forcefully by people who consider themselves liberals. People
like
Michael Ignatieff, for example, who is the director of the Harvard University Carr Center for Human Rights. And it's a rhetoric that justifies empire, justifies a new form of colonialism in the language of spreading human rights.
How much of this new white man's burden is a response to the fact that without the Cold War, there really isn't a moral justification for invading countries?
Oh, I think it's very important to put it in that context, Bob. The collapse of the Cold War left the United States in a situation where the planners of empire had to consider, how are we going to justify intervention? How are we going to justify having military bases in other countries? How are we going to justify having military relationships, organizations like NATO? How are we going to justify invading countries that we don't like if we don't have the framework of toppling communist regimes, of opposing the threat of the Soviet Union, the worldwide conspiracy of communism, as it was called? And with the collapse of that framework, the United States has had to look for new justifications for intervention. And Iraq has been a testing ground for those. In 1991, certainly that was behind the thinking of the then Bush administration, Bush Sr., companions in the government considered what was at stake in invading Iraq. They wanted to create a demonstration effect of the right and the ability of the United States to be a global policeman in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Cold War framework. That was connected to the invasion of Panama as well, and also the intervention in Somalia in 1993. And I think we've seen an ongoing development of that framework, and it's unfortunately, rather than challenging a framework of intervention and the lies that are used to justify intervention, a number of liberal intellectuals are providing the framework that's being used to bolster it.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Anthony Arnov, author of the brand new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, published by New Press with a foreword and afterword by Howard Zinn. A short and concise and powerful argument for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. In the book, you have a chapter on the resistance in Iraq, what's going on the ground. From our news media, from what I see, basically, it sounds like Iraq is, you know, a living hellhole of sort of crazed violence. Is that accurate? And if I'm wrong, what am I missing?
terrible one. So we shouldn't trivialize the extent to which there's horrific violence taking place. But I think we have to step back and look at a couple of things. First of all, the greatest conflict in Iraq today is between an occupation that the majority of the Iraqi people reject and those who would resist that occupation. So the major conflict in the society isn't between Sunni and Shia or between Arab and Kurd or between various factions of Shia or Sunni. It's between the Iraqi people who are under occupation and an occupying force. And that gets another issue, which is important, which is that the United States is trying to say and has repeatedly said that the major source of violence in Iraq has been foreign fighters or has been influenced by other countries that are meddling in Iraq's affairs, countries like Iran or Syria or Jordan. And the largest group of foreign fighters in Iraq today is not from Syria, is not from Saudi Arabia, from Jordan, or Iran. It's from the United States and the coalition, which has sent more than 170,000 troops in total into Iraq that are, in many cases, terrorizing the Iraqi people. And the Haditha massacre is not some aberration. The Abu Ghraib torture scandal is not some aberration. They're a logical outcome of an occupation. And there are many more examples of torture and of massacres, which will come to light, and in some cases have come to light, but haven't been properly discussed, fully discussed in the media. But the Bush administration, Pentagon spokespeople, want to portray the violence in Iraq as being only caused by a handful of foreign fighters, or what they call dead-enders, Ba'athist remnants. As if anyone who opposes the U.S. occupation must be a supporter of Saddam Hussein. But the reality is you look at demonstrations that have taken place in Iraq, in some cases mass demonstrations with Sunni and Shia marching together, something that's received very little attention in the corporate press here, and they march under banners that oppose Saddam Hussein and oppose occupation. It's possible to oppose both. And the resistance that's taking place in Iraq takes many different forms. Some of them have nothing to do with opposing occupation, but are indeed sectarian, are indeed terrorist, completely indefensible acts of violence that have nothing to do with opposing occupation or bringing about national liberation in Iraq. But a lot of the acts of violence do, and have the support of the Iraqi people. The British intelligence estimate of the popular support for armed attacks on occupying forces estimated that Iraqis support those attacks in the range of 45% to 65%.
Our guest today, Anthony Arnov, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Anthony Arnov's new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. While we talk about how all the reasons given by the U.S. government for the invasion have been blown up and shown to be untrue, the real arguments now are about whether to withdraw or when to withdraw or how quickly to withdraw. That's really what the debates are. And you go through systematically each of the claims that are made by proponents of remaining in Iraq, and I think logically counter them. What, in your view, what are the two or three most current claims, the claims that people are hearing the most, the equivalent of weapons of mass destruction, so to speak, for staying the course in Iraq, for keeping hundreds of thousands of troops there indefinitely? And then give your explanation for why you don't think those claims hold up.
Well, you know, the first big lie of this war was weapons of mass destruction. But now we've got a set of new lies. And the new lies are that the United States has to stay in Iraq to bring democracy to Iraq, that the United States has to stay in Iraq to prevent civil war from breaking out, and that the United States has to stay in Iraq to confront the terrorists there rather than confronting them here in the streets of New York or Washington.
Or Urbana.
Or Urbana, for that matter. Perhaps you got some of those federal anti-terrorism dollars that that everyone's fighting about. But each of those things is untrue. The United States didn't intervene to bring democracy to Iraq or bring democracy to the Middle East. I think that goes back to the discussion of the new white man's burden. It's a very nice way of selling intervention to the American public to say we have to bring democracy to people who have lived under tyranny. It's not a new idea. It's been used in many cases before. But this idea that Bush has a messianic commitment to the spread of democracy provides a much more effective way of selling war than of saying we want to dominate other people, we want to control their oil, we want to topple governments that we don't like and set up ones that we do. And the occupation is not bringing about democracy, it's negating democracy. The Iraqi people have made it clear in many ways that if there were genuine democracy, genuine popular decision-making in Iraq, Iraq's oil would be in Iraqi hands and would not be dominated by foreign interests, that the country's economic laws would not allow 100% foreign ownership, as they now do, over every aspect of the economy except for oil, which was a consequence of the laws passed by L. Paul Bremer III, the colonial pro-council of Iraq imposed by the United States right after the invasion. And that the occupation would end. So we're negating democracy in Iraq. We're not spreading democracy in Iraq. In terms of civil war, the United States is actually fueling civil war, and every day that they're there, the likelihood of civil war escalating is even greater.
So the United States,
today we have a low-scale civil war.
So the United States leaving wouldn't precipitate a bloodbath?
Well, I think the United States leaving is going to leave Iraq in a mess. They've created a mess, and just the withdrawal of U.S. troops won't in of itself reverse all of the damage that's been caused and all of the internecine conflict that's been fueled by the occupation. But I would say two things. First of all, I would say those of us who are calling for a withdrawal of troops aren't doing so from an isolationist standpoint. We're not saying we don't care about the Iraqi people. We should abandon the Iraqi people. Their problems don't concern us. Quite the opposite. We're saying out of concern for the Iraqi people, we need to end an occupation which is causing them so much suffering. But I also think we have to talk very seriously about the obligation of the United States to pay reparations and the obligation of the U.S. allies to pay reparations
to
the Iraqi people.
Yeah, what sort of reparations would be appropriate by historical standards?
Well, I mean, the reparations, let's absolutely look in historical terms. The U.S. should pay reparations not just for the harm and suffering caused by the invasion and occupation, which were undertaken under utterly false premises. That's now been exposed quite clearly. But before that, 13 years of sanctions, which didn't hurt the political elite, but hurt the most vulnerable, the poorest, the children, the elderly in Iraq. Before that, the 1991 Gulf War, which left a horrible toxic legacy in the country, which badly destroyed its infrastructure. Before that, all of the years that the United States supported Saddam Hussein during his worst crimes, the very crimes that were then used as justification for toppling him, when he was armed, backed, supplied, protected by the United States. And before that, even the U.S. support for the rise of Saddam Hussein and rise of the Ba'ath Party as a counterweight to the Iraqi Communist Party and to the secular parties, which today, unfortunately, has its echo in the lack of a secular nationalist left in Iraq, the destruction of that, which the U.S. bears a significant responsibility for, as they do throughout the entire Middle East, where they've supported Islamic and fundamentalist currents as alternatives to secular, nationalist, socialist currents.
I think I'm about to get sticker shock.
It's a very high price. But the reality is the U.S. is spending hundreds of billions of dollars to occupy Iraq today, and the indirect economic costs have been estimated by Joseph Stiglitz at Columbia University at $1.5 trillion. And certainly some of that money could be far better spent on job training programs, relief for Hurricane Katrina victims, but also could be far better spent by the Iraqi people who would have an interest in turning on the power, would have an interest in building schools and hospitals, and they can spend the money far better than Kellogg, Brown and Root and Blackwater Security can.
Anthony Aronoff, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to turn to the home front again, because this book is written to Americans primarily to get them to pressure politicians to withdraw troops immediately from Iraq. How, I mean, the argument for withdrawal, how common is that found in the halls of Congress? Are there members of Congress who have taken up this banner and leading the fight now to force the administration to withdraw the troops immediately?
Well, when I say the logic of withdrawal in my title, I don't think it's the case that George Bush or members of Congress are going to pick up this book and be compelled by the logic to realize that they need to pull troops out. What I'm hoping is that ordinary people are going to see the logic, that military families, people who have children and brothers and sisters who have been sent off to Iraq, that soldiers themselves, that students who are being targeted by military recruiters, that working class and poor people who are being targeted by recruiters come to see the logic of withdrawal, and that we can build the kind of popular movement that can put pressure on politicians to do something that right now there's really no constituency among the political elite calling for.
I mean, there's no...
There is Jack Murtha in the Democratic Party who's called for a redeployment, which is really an argument for shifting U.S. strategy in the Middle East towards relying more on air power than on troops on the ground. And now he's been savaged for that position. And it's one thing to distinguish between the unprincipled response of a lot of his Democratic colleagues and the Republicans who are attacking him for raising this question of shifting troops out of Iraq. But the reality is he hasn't articulated a principled position of, look, we had no business going to Iraq in the first place, and we're only creating more harm by staying. That's more a strategy about how the U.S. best achieves its goals in Iraq and in the region.
You know,
I think it's going to take a larger constituency to push for that.
Anthony Aronoff, we've only got about 30 seconds left. Perhaps you could tell people, recommend a website or two to go to if they want to find out more about not only your book, but also just about what's going on in Iraq and what people are concerned about the war can do about it.
Sure. I'd highly recommend Iraq Veterans Against War, IVAW.net. You can read more about my book and also a tour that I'm on with members of IVAW and Howard Zinn and Studs Terkel and Cindy Sheehan and other people who are mobilizing to get the troops home now at endofthewartour.org.
Okay, thank you very much, Anthony Aronoff, for joining us today on Media Matters, for being our guest. Anthony Aronoff, the author of the brand new book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, published by New Press. My name is Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters, and I'll be back in 167 hours.